Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 7, Further Inquiries by Vidura, text number 40. Etanme pichattaha prasnan. Hare karma vivatsaya. Bruhi me jasya nit. Mitratvad Ajaya Nasta Chakshusha Etanme Pichattaha Prashnan. Okay. Etan, all these. Me, my. Pichattaha, for one who inquires. Prajnan, questions. Hare, of the Supreme Lord. Karma, pastimes. Vivitsaiha, desiring to know. Guruhi, kindly describe. Me, unto me. Agyasya, of one who is ignorant. Mitratvat, because of friendship. Ajaya, by the external energy. Nasta Chakshusha, those who have lost their vision. Translation. My dear sage, I have put all these questions before you with a view to knowing the pastimes of Hari, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You are the friend of all, so kindly describe them for all those who have lost their vision. We'll do that responsibly. My dear sage, I have put all these questions before you with a view to knowing the pastimes of Hari, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You are the friend of all. So kindly describe them for all those who have lost their vision. Purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Vidura put forward many varieties of questions with a view to understanding the principles of transcendental loving service to the Lord. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, text 41, devotional service to the Lord is one, and the mind of the devotee is not diverted to the many branches of uncertainties. Vidura's purpose was to be situated in that service of the Lord wherein one merges undivertedly. He claimed the friendship of Maitreya Muni not because he was Maitreya's son, but because Maitreya was actually the friend of all who have lost their spiritual vision due to material intelligence. So I'll read the verse again. Etanme pichita prasnam hare karma vivitsaya bruhi me gyasya mitratvad Ajaya Nasta Chakshusha. My dear sage, I have put all these questions before you with a view to knowing the pastimes of Hari, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You are the friend of all, so kindly describe them for all those who have lost their vision. So, have the last few verses here in this chapter 7 with many questions by Vidura to Maitreya Muni. And these, we see that he's put forward many very intelligent, very deep questions in order to, but his purpose there is to become fixed up in pure devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and to be situated in that one service with his mind and senses and words, all without any diversion at all to anything else. So that's the purpose of his inquiries. Generally, people don't ask questions like this. the other night I went to Bhakti Bhavan and we had a discussion. Were you there? No? You were there. Were you there the other last Saturday?
Last Saturday?
Last Saturday. No. So there's a lot of members of the Indian congregation, or new, you know, people have been around for maybe 6 months or so, but have, you know, been getting some good association with Vichananda Priya and his, you know, all the team down there at Bhakti Bhavan. Anyway, they asked me to speak on Krishna, and of course, you know that when you're speaking to new people, especially from the Indian congregation, their mind's going to be fixed on anything else but Krishna. There's this God, that God, that, you know, like that. So I asked them just to, I was asking that you know, what is your background, you know, in your family tradition coming down from generations, who does your family worship? And so they were describing, you know, different, you know, someone was Ganesh, someone was Kali, someone was Dattatreya, someone was Krishna. But even those who the worship was Krishna, you know, they admitted that although their family, that was their prime deity, but when others in the neighbourhood had a festival worshipping their particular family deity, they all sort of joined in like that, and they considered it all equal. Okay. So whether they worship Krishna or Ganesh, so, you know, they... and what struck me was that the prime reason that they were worshipping those particular gods was not because somewhere along the line someone had asked questions and researched the Vedic literatures as to who should be worshipped and for what purpose, but simply because it was just passed down. That's what their family had done, and therefore that's what they would do. And that's what their children will do. And that will go on for thousands of years like that. So, you know, that was really interesting for me. And, you know, the surprising thing, it was very interesting for them, because I don't think they quite, the penny had really dropped, that that's what they were doing. So when, you know, when I said that, you know, it's like even they were a bit surprised. Oh, geez, what we're doing like that. People, you know, even, you know, not just Hinduism, but, you know, people are born in a Muslim country, they will worship Allah. They will follow the Muslim tradition. And if they're born in a particular community, they will worship Allah with a particular mood. Some will be very militant, some will be very peaceful, some will be very meditative, some will be very saintly, some will be very material. It just depends upon, you know, the mood of that community. They will worship him in, you know, not all in the same mood. Same with Christianity. Depends where you're born. You will take up worship of the Father of Jesus. I'm not sure what they call it. Jehovah. Some call him Jehovah. Or if you're born in the Jewish community, Yahweh, and that. You're born in the Buddhist community, and that. There's not a... they generally won't question the mode of worship or, you know, anything, or, you know, should be worshipped, you know, in another way, in a different religion. It's just what is going on in that community that would just be passed on like that. So, what happens there, of course, is that a lot of that worship is based upon, as long as one's material requisites, prerequisites are being satisfied, one will continue that worship. So we see that in Prabhupada mentions that in India, many of the Hindus, when the Muslims took over, they put a special tax on the Hindus, so that, you know, it was more difficult financially. You were better off to be a Muslim, and also, as Prabhupada mentions, the Brahmanas were treating the Sudras, which made up practically the whole population, as untouchable. Oh, you know, I don't even look at you. You know, don't walk down the same street as me. Imagine doing that. You're sort of walking down the street and the Brahma says, don't you ever walk down this street again. You go the back lane like that. I don't want to have to see your face. So the Brahmins have become very proud, you know. And so a lot of the Hindus thought, we'll get a better deal with the Muslims. And so, you know, they become a huge proportion of Muslims are Hindus. And we have the same happening in the Western world now, that although people are born in Christian countries, many of them feel that society, especially if they're somehow or another, you know, don't feel that they're accepted by society for one reason or another, and they may take to, you know, you see that they may become disenchanted and, take to, you know, Muslim religion, not so much out of love of Allah, but out of disturbance within the society that they're living in. You know, they don't necessarily research, oh, Allah's like this, Allah's like that, you know, Muslim like this. It's I'm so disturbed, and some almost out of a rebellious nature, let me say. So therefore, when there's no... When religion or one's worship or deity is chosen out of family tradition or... and generally based upon one's material well-being, there's no resolute determination to stick to that path. As soon as someone comes along and offers a better deal somewhere, they will change their faith. Just like actually in China. In China now, Christianity... I think there are more Christians than practically any other group in China. And of course, what's happened in China is that in the last 20 years or so, the economy has boomed. So you have a whole nation, practically within our lifetime, we've been able to see that literally you have a country with a huge problem with poverty, and now that same population are all becoming wealthy within, you know, a short time. But what they've also seen in their lifetime is the destruction of their rivers, the land, and the environment, which is against their original, sort of Taoist traditions, where nature is to be respected, because it's been created by the gods, like that. So many of them are turning to religion. And now, even within the Communist Party, the Christianity is so big and unstoppable that a communist is now allowed to go to church. Because previously, a communist wasn't allowed to go to church and worship. But now you can actually be a communist and go to church and be a Christian as well. That's accepted because times have changed. But so they've, many of them have changed from their traditional religions, then to communism, then to Christianity, and in the future they'll change again according to the prevailing circumstance, like that. So change. But you don't see that they actually research. That's not the reason why they change. It's usually because there's some better deal and they feel more accepted, and they're able to, there's a sense of spirituality. I mean, underlying everything, people do yearn for a sense of spirituality, but sometimes it can be, a very shallow sense of spirituality. But there's an element of bhakti there. But because the main element there is strong material desires to be fulfilled, it's not really bhakti. So there's, Prabhupada often mentions that, when the Muslims pray, when the Buddhists pray, when the Christians pray, there's bhakti. There's Shravanam, Kirtanam, Smaranam, Parasevanam, Archanam, Dasyam, Sakyam, Vandanam, Dasyam, Sakyam, Atmanavedanam. So Vandanam, Prabhupada calls it, when they're praying, that's Vandanam. This is a bhakti. They're praying to God, so it's bhakti. There's an element of bhakti there. But it's not bhakti proper when we're principally praying for material desires to be fulfilled. That's not bhakti proper, but there's an element there. Here we see from the devotees, they do things in a whole different way. Here, Vidura is actually asking, the most, many, many varieties of questions, deeply penetrating into the subject, leaving no stone unturned, in order to leave no doubt whatsoever and to fix one's resolve as to who should be the supreme worshipable Lord devote one to surrender to at that. So that is the bhakti path. That is different. That is the difference between bhakti and other forms of faith. You won't find that. And if someone does have that, strong desire to actually understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who should be worshipped and how, generally they will come to Krishna consciousness anyway. Because by comparative understanding, naturally, and by one's sincerity, gradually one will actually be led to Krishna consciousness. So, Prabhupada mentions this verse in the Bhagavad Gita, as stated in the Bhagavad Gita 2.41, devotional service to the Lord is one, And the mind of the devotee is not diverted to the many branches of uncertainties. So, this verse from the Bhagavad Gita is, you know, Vidura's single-pointed, what do they call that? Vyavasayatmika buddhiya. Resolute, you know, determination. Resolute determination. That is a quality that you'll find within the devotee. It is a quality of devotional service. That, you know, as long as we're doing some sort of business for our own purpose, we won't resolutely stick with one person. You know, if you go to a shop and you're doing business with one person, you're buying cars, you know, every couple of years you upgrade your car, and they look after you, treat you well, and then you find next time you go to buy a car, the person, you know, the opposition, the car sales, they're actually doing a better deal. So you just change like that. You know, there's no, it's business. It's business. You don't fall in love with the car salesman. Oh, he's like a brother to me, you know. He's like, you know, I got this nice holding from him. You know, he's like part of the family, you know. It's just business. Bhakti is based upon love for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, you know, it's a resolute, it's not doing business. And it has these qualities. These are mentioned in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that Krishna is encouraging Arjuna, and of course encouraging us, about taking up bhakti yoga, because it is supreme among all processes. And he's saying taking up bhakti yoga, and that bhakti means to worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead, not the demigods. So in verse 240 he describes that if you perform devotional service, it's never lost. The results of that bhakti is never lost. And in the same verse, it also protects you from the greatest danger, being somehow, you know, lost in the cycle of birth and death in some terrible situation. And then in the this verse, 241, it describes that the characteristics of bhakti is that there is a resolute determination, because it is based upon transcendental knowledge of the benefit of the soul initially. Initially, the understanding of the Supreme Personality of Godhead may be there, but bhakti is based upon the eternal benefit of the soul. Whereas most religious processes described in the Vedas mainly deal, or you know, other religious processes mainly deal with the modes of material nature, fulfilling one's material, you know, requirements by, you know, invoking those material benedictions from the Lord. So bhakti has that resolute determination, because one is looking after the interest of the soul. When we look after the interest of the body, then you have so many desires to fulfill. If you look after the interest of the soul, there's just one. All the desires associated with the material body don't fit into that category. All the unlimited desires in this material world don't fit into that category of looking after the soul. So there's looking after the soul, and then there's one desire, and then all the unlimited desires in the material world, they're associated with looking after the body. So only those who take up bhakti, even initially looking after the interests of the soul, trying to understand the Supreme Person of Godhead, they can have resolute determination. They can be situated in that oneness. And if, in verse 44, it describes that if one is attached to material opulence or sense enjoyment, they create obstacles, you know, to having that resolute determination or to developing that bhakti. also in that same verse 45 describes that the bhakti, although it's in the Vedas, it's transcendental. Krishna asked Arjuna, you rise above the majority of those things in the Vedas, you take that transcendental element, that bhakti. And that in the next verse he describes, if you perform bhakti, it will fulfill all requirements. There's no need to perform any other activity. So this also makes it very easy to be resolute in devotional service, because a devotee understands if you perform bhakti to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, everything that is required to be done and satisfied, all duties that need to be executed, they're all fulfilled by bhakti yoga. In other words, if you worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead nicely, all the demigods be satisfied, you don't have to offer worship to them. Your relatives are satisfied, society is satisfied, you're satisfied, all living entities are satisfied. You don't have to separately engage in any other activity. You don't have any other duty to do. You know, in the same chapter, he describes verses 50-51 that, you know, by performing bhakti, all your sinful reactions are taken away. At that as well. Which is different from other processes, because actually, if you perform karma yoga, you're performing your duties, you know, as good as you possibly can. If you don't complete that activity, say you're worshipping a demigod, or you're even looking after your children, your parents, something, performing your duty in this world, one way or another, your material duty, if you don't execute it properly, you are susceptible to the sinful reaction of not executing your duty. So you're trying to do something pious, but if you fail to do it, if you fail to actually get the proper result of performing your duty, you are then subject to the sinful reaction of not performing your duty. Whereas with bhakti, it's described, there are different verses, just like in Srimad Bhagavatam 1.5.17. One who has forsaken his material occupations to engage in the devotional service of the Lord may sometimes fall down while in an immature stage, yet there is no danger of his being unsuccessful. On the other hand, a non-devotee, though fully engaged in occupational duties, does not gain anything. So therefore, as also described, Krishna describes verse 52 of that second chapter, that therefore one becomes indifferent to the Vedic rituals by performing bhakti. And in verse 51 it also describes that one not only becomes free from sinful reactions, but one becomes free from the cycle of birth and death, which is also not achieved in the other processes. And in verse 53 it describes that one attains samadhi, or realization of one's relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, you know, ultimately, goes back to Godhead. So, Krishna, just in a few short verses of the Bhagavad Gita, describing the glories of bhakti, when one hears about bhakti, one can have resolute determination that all I need to do is bhakti. I don't need to do anything else. All I need to do is worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead and become situated in bhakti. And actually, Prabhupada mentions that, you know, just like if we see that, you know, there's scriptural injunctions that if one is a brahmana and they don't perform the Gabbadana samskara, that means the, you know, ceremony in order to, you know, the proper Vedic purification ceremony for the conception of a child, as described, if that is not performed by a brahmana, one may think, oh, maybe the child will become sudra. But actually the injunction is the whole family becomes sudra. And of course, if the whole family becomes sudra, and they may then take their next birth in sudra bodies. Therefore, you find that now, Prabhupada mentions, but if, you know, amongst those brahmanas, if somehow or another they've engaged in some devotional service, and perhaps they, you know, become sudras in the next life, there's no problem for them, because they get swept back up into devotional service, and by devotional service they come to the brahminical platform anyway. So, you know, you see that by even just a small amount of devotional service, they're protected from any fall down. And when Prabhupada was in New Vrindavan, he said that. He said that in one lecture, that June 21, 1969, he's giving a verse from the Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 5, verses 17, which is the one I just quoted there, 17 and 18. He says that, but see, practically, even though we've fallen in this abominable condition, some way or another, but because in their last life they had some advancement of Krishna consciousness, you know, according to verse 240, even a little advancement, even just a little, immediately they are taking up, he said, a little advancement in Krishna consciousness, immediately they are taking up. So those who are joining in this movement in this country, they were supposed to be previously Krishna conscious. Somehow or another, they could not execute Krishna consciousness in full. So Prabhupada is describing that you know, many devotees, you know, who are spread throughout all the various countries of the world, that because there's some beginning in Krishna consciousness, generally, in Nectar Devotion, Rupa Goswami says, you can't begin Krishna consciousness unless you've performed in your previous lifetime. So Prabhupada is saying they were supposed to be Krishna conscious. There must be some Krishna consciousness. So therefore they're being swept back up to Krishna consciousness again. Even though somehow or another, because there's a beginning but there's not full Krishna consciousness in their previous life, but materially they may have been trying to execute their duties very nicely and fallen down, you know, as everyone does in Kali Yuga, you know, falling down from the brahminical platform of the platform of sattva to rajas and tamas, like that. Everyone is coming down to rajas and tamas, you know. like that. But if there's a little bit of Krishna consciousness, they have no fear like that. What to speak of those who are taking up Krishna consciousness very solidly. But you know, when it mentions that one has to perform Krishna consciousness in their previous lifetime, we understand that the beginning of that may be Agata Sukriti. Just like they have Harinam Kirtan. Someone hears the holy name of the Lord. There's another nice verse here. Prabhupada quotes a verse here somewhere in this, that if someone, even if they're born in a Chandala family, some people, you know, eat almost anything, including dogs, and, they're not really within any proper religious principle. There's really a lot of tamagun, even if they're following some religious principles. A lot of tamagun. But if one is, even a very low birth in one sense, their circumstances, if they hear the holy name of the Lord, that person can be immediately elevated to the transcendental position, and ultimately go back to the spiritual world. And the same with people take prasadam. Prabhupada says in one lecture, what is the result of eating prasadam is event in the next life they become a devotee. They eat so much prasadam, and when they may not become a devotee in this life, but the next life, that prasadam will take effect. Krishna will make some better arrangement, and that little bit of faith that's developed, that purification, it dawns as the first little bit of faith. Let me inquire, like Vidura is. Seriously, I'm following all sorts of things by society and tradition and sense gratification, but let me inquire purposefully actually about this, Krishna consciousness. Who is God? And, like that. Let me search, let me ask some serious questions. That dawning of faith is a result of Agata Sukriti. Someone has, devotees have engaged someone unwillingly or unknowingly in devotional service, and that is the beginning of their devotional service, and therefore, as Prabhupada says, even that small amount, but they may, because of so many sinful activities and being entangled and being attached to the lower modes, they may take birth in very difficult situation in the lower modes of material nature, but that little bit of Krishna consciousness will act, and they'll be swept up into Krishna consciousness, and that Krishna consciousness has the ability that within that lifetime, even if the person is the most sinful person by birth in one sense in their activities they grow up with, that person can become qualified to perform all sorts of, spiritual activities and to engage others in spiritual activities and to teach, the Vedas to others like that. So, yes. So here we see this is what we learn from such personalities as Vidura. And you'll see this within every devotee. Every devotee, a sincere devotee, you'll see that they love to, research properly about Krishna consciousness. Always, studying the scriptures, asking questions, and You know, trying to find out, just making sure that if there's any doubt or anything that's you know, a distraction to the ultimate goal of the soul, to be properly situated in its eternal position, which means as the eternal servant of Krishna, devotees are always you know, inquiring and researching with great single-minded determination, you know, how that can be achieved. And of course, Prabhupada mentions in that verse that yesterday's verse and also in 241 in the Bhagavad Gita, that is achieved by accepting the spiritual master as one's supreme guide and friend. Because the spiritual master is a representative of Krishna, one takes full shelter. You see in the Nectar Devotion, devotional service properly begins, you know, in seriousness. That is the first step, that one takes shelter of a spiritual master. You know, one, you know, finds some very, very experienced, well-situated devotee, elevated devotee, who is very expert and fully realized in Krishna consciousness, and one, you know, takes shelter. Let me learn from that person, and gradually inquires from that person, and then, you know, may take initiation from that person, and then may also follow the rules and regulations and the instructions very fully. And those beginning steps of devotional service are tantamount to bhakti. Bhakti is there. That resolute determination. That, you know, it manifests when one does that. One takes shelter of a spiritual master. There's that. Yes, there's that resolute determination. Bhakti can be there to some degree, but you know, it's a big step. It's a real, everyone knows, you know, it's a very serious step when one takes shelter, you know. Otherwise, without the being obliged to follow the instructions of a spiritual master, we tend to be literally doing as we please in spiritual life. Our sense gratification can literally be guiding us, you know, as it has done for many, many generations like that, as to, you know, our spiritual life is literally being guided by our mind and our senses, you know, like that. But when one takes shelter of the spiritual master and inquires very, very sincerely, and then takes those instructions of the spiritual master very seriously, and bhakti is really taking shape properly. That is a manifestation. Therefore, Prabhupada, when he read this verse from 241, he was struck with wonder at Vishvanatha Chakravarti's wonderful commentary on that. I'll just read his commentary to verse 241, and we'll just finish there. Find that here. He says, Srila Vishvanatha Chakravarti the Core writes, "Of all kinds of intelligence, the best is intelligence focused on bhakti yoga. In bhakti yoga, one's intelligence becomes single-pointed or fixed in determination. One thinks, the instructions of my spiritual master to worship the personality of Godhead by chanting, remembering, serving his feet and so on are my only sadhana, my only sadhya, my only livelihood. I am incapable of giving up these instructions either in the stage of practice or in the stage of perfection. They alone are my object of desire and my only responsibility. Besides them, I can desire no other responsibility, not even in my dreams. It is all the same to me, whether I feel happy or unhappy, or whether my material existence is eradicated or not." That's the symptom of bhakti, resolute determination, having that faith in the spiritual master, the representative of Krishna. So I'll just leave it there if anyone has any questions or comments.
Yep.
sure. Okay. Nishti goes to for restaurants, that one. the nature of devotee is that having single-minded focus on Krishna means that they see Krishna everywhere, and therefore they see all living entities as part and parcel of Krishna. And they understand that every living entity is a spirit soul and very dear to Krishna. So, you know, they don't want to do anything unnecessary to cause harm to other living entities. So I don't want to go into specifics, but sometimes, just like with Yudhisthira Maharaj, he had to kill here because he was removing not just insects and bugs and what have you. He was removing human beings. It described that, you know, the Pandavas under Yudhisthira Maharaj, they were, you know, eradicating the soldiers on the battlefield, just like a farmer, you know, eradicates the weeds in his fields. So that, just like, you know, one may pull up a weed, they're just eradicating human beings like that. And the same, you know. So some, you know, so I don't want to go into specifics, but but Krishna wanted it. So, you know, this is what a devotee has to always, see is, is this something that's satisfying Krishna, or, you know, is it something I want? So we see that with Arjuna, Yudhisthira, they were not prepared to harm even an ant if it was not what Krishna wanted. But if Krishna wanted it, they were prepared to eradicate everyone wholesale. So, you know, so that's the principle. I won't go into detail, but that's the principle. Okay. All right, so we'll just leave it there. Thank you. Any other questions? Yep. Yes, the dangers of that, as Prabhupada mentions in that section of the, I think it was that, the Srimad Bhagavatam verse, 1.5.17 that was quoted there, that sometimes devotees who do become, because the obstacles for that resolute determination is if one again becomes attracted to sense gratification or material opulence, enjoying those things for, you know, one's purpose, one can, instead of being fixed up in, you know, the service of the spiritual master for Krishna, one becomes engaged in other activities, and one can fall down from devotional service, even from a very elevated platform, such as Bharat Maharaj, who fell down from practically the platform of Bhava Bhakti and became a deer. So the danger is that if a devotee again becomes irresolute by becoming attracted to other things, they can fall down, even take birth in the animal species. But the benefit is that they're never lost. Therefore, because Bharat Maharaj had performed devotional service, he was given the opportunity that he could remember his past life as a devotee. See, that's a special. So the performance of bhakti saved him. So even as a deer, he was able to quickly take himself back to the proper platform in the next lifetime. Okay? That facility of being protected even when one falls down. So bhakti is like that, that you know, if one is very immature and does not become fully perfected Krishna consciousness in this lifetime, we don't know what where we will end up in our next life. We don't know what birth we may take, and there may be some, you know, disturbing situations we have to face as a result of, you know, maybe offences to Krishna, offences to Guru, offences to Shastra, offences to Vaishnavas, or sinful activities, you know, against the holy name, you know, like that. So we may have to take birth and suffer all sorts of different reactions like that, where Krishna purifies us of that tendency to enjoy in this material world, even as a devotee. And then the bhakti at some stage will kick in, and one will come back to exactly where they left off. So that's the benefit of bhakti. You're guaranteed that you'll be given the opportunity very quickly to come back to the platform where you left off. That's, it's never lost. Never lost. It can be stalled for some time, your progress. And we may end up in a bit of a pickle, a bit of a difficult situation in the material world. As we know, you know, devotees take birth in all sorts of places all over the world. And some of them, you know, some take birth in the middle of a war zone, some take birth in, you know, as Barrett, in an animal, in a deer. Some take birth in very, you know, they may go for many, many years of extreme difficulty where Krishna has to, you know, purify them in one lifetime. Not over thousands of lifetimes, but in one lifetime Krishna will slap them around a bit. Don't you do that again. You take it seriously this time. And then they, you know, come back. Then he gives them the opportunity when they think. You know, I never forget the first moment I literally found the Gita. I've told this story a few times, but I'll tell it because it fits this. You know, I was a typical Western teenager, trying my best to enjoy as a teenager in the Western world, and suffering like anything, suffering. I hated it. I hated my life, you know. I every weekend was a party since I was 10. I'll say no more. I was smoking at 10 and drinking, I know, 10 years old. And my father used to let me wander out in the street. I could come home at 2 o'clock if I wanted, even as a kid. It was a very wild existence. And but, you know, by the time I got to about 18 and 19, or even years before that, I was so disturbed that you know, I felt my life was so shallow and empty. And literally I was just suffering, you know, intoxication, good, a lot, you know, so many things. And I thought, I can't stand to do this anymore, not for even one more second. I was at a party when I was thinking like that. I was actually at a party, intoxicated. And I was saying, I can't stand this any longer. You know? And I reached into the library. I thought, I'm just going to pick out the biggest book I can, and I'm just going to sit here, and I'm bored with all you guys. I don't want anything. I pulled out the bag of the Gita. And, you know, my eyes are sort of rolling all over the place because I was quite intoxicated. But I thought, this is what I'm looking for, you know. And I went downstairs and I tried to read it, and I thought, this is it, but, you know, I need to be sober to read it. And, you know, so I said to the lady who owned the party, who was an ex-girlfriend, I said, can I have this book? And we'd broken up, you know, and she said, I'll give you this book if you give me your diary, because she wanted to read about the breakup in my diary. So I said, yeah, you have the diary. I never used to write anything bad about people anyway. And I took the Bhagavad Gita. But, you know, I never forget at that point where I was disgusted with material existence, the Bhagavad Gita literally jumped in my hand. Just like that. At that point. So, you know, you can see that, you know, it's like that. You know, sometimes for one reason or another, you know, Krishna puts you, there's some, you know, Krishna consciousness, there may be a little beginning, but it's not enough. And there may be all sorts of things done improperly. So you take birth and there's some, you know, serious, you know, reactions. And then, you know, but you immediately, you're given that opportunity. And as Prabhupada says in that quote, he says, you know, then immediately they come. Like that, you know, if there's some strong sense of Krishna consciousness, you know, the opportunity is there. They're like, yeah, that's me, that's my way out. Like that. So, and in another, you know, lecture, you know, I heard Prabhupada, that it's sometimes a little indication how much devotional service may be there. That, you know, when an opportunity is there and when someone takes to it very quickly, spontaneously, really grabs a hold of that devotional service. It's a good, you know, it means it may have, they've really got a taste from their previous life. In the Nectar of Devotion, it says, what saves a devotee is the bhakti ras. It's that taste, that bhakti ras. When you perform, just like, you know, I say to some of these people, that the children come to do, I did a ceremony the other day for a little girl, she was about 9 months old. So I started kirtan, and her little legs start dancing away like this, you know. I mean, she can't stand or anything. I said to him, stand her up, you know, and she's, both legs are going. And she's like this, she got a big smile. She's 9 months old. But, you know, I can see that bhakti ras, she may never find that sense of happiness and well-being and peace again in her life, except with devotees. And that moment, she will search for even in her next life if she doesn't attain it. You know, that it's that bhakti ras, and when you taste it, I remember I used to read the Gita. I used to open the Gita and I'd read it, and when I'd say Krishna, I'd be like licking my lips. I'd be thinking, you know, Krishna, there's something. It's not like a word. It's like, you know, I'm tasting something. What is that? It's like there's a bhakti ras there. So, you know, it's not just. I didn't understand Bhagavad Gita, but I could taste something, you know, just reading Krishna's name. And I'll tell you why I know I didn't understand Bhagavad Gita. Because I didn't have many jobs, but I had one for a couple of weeks where I was a landscape gardener. And we used to, you do a lawn. So first you get all the dirt and you rake up all the rubble and things like that. You put it in a wheelbarrow and then you just sort of throw that rubbish over the edge. So I was reading the Bhagavad Gita and I'd fill up the barrel with all the rubbish and then I'd be thinking, I'm supposed to offer everything to Krishna. So I'd go to the edge and, there you go, Krishna, I don't know what you want with all this rubbish, but, you know, it's yours, I'm offering everything to you, like that. So, you know, I had no real understanding of bhakti at all, but there was a taste, you know, there's that bhakti ras is there. So it's not intellectual, like that. Anyway. Hare Krishna.
Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 7, Further Inquiries by the Dura, text number 40. Etanme Pichattaha Prasnam.
Lost their vision.
Translation. My dear personality of Godhead. You are the friend of all, so kindly describe them for all those who have lost their vision. My dear sage, I have put all these questions before you.
I have put all these questions before you.
With a view to knowing the pastimes of Hari.
With a view to knowing the pastimes of Hari.
The Supreme Personality of Godhead.
The Supreme Personality of Godhead.
You are the friend of all.
You are the friend of all.
So kindly describe them for all those.
So kindly describe them for all those.
Lost their vision.
Who have lost their vision.
Report by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Vidura put forward many varieties of questions with a view to understanding the principles of transcendental loving service to the Lord. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, text 41, devotional service to the Lord is one, and the mind of the devotee is not diverted to the many branches of uncertainties. Vidura's purpose was to be situated in that service of the Lord wherein one merges undivertedly. He claimed the friendship of Maitreya Muni not because he was Maitreya's son, but because Maitreya was actually the friend of all who had lost their spiritual vision due to material intelligence. Etanme vichitha bhasnam hare karma vichaya bruhime yasya mitratva ajaya aschachamshusha. My dear sage, I have put all these questions before you with a view to knowing the pastimes of Hari, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You are the friend of all, so kindly describe them for all those who have lost their vision. So, the last few verses here, in this chapter 7, with many questions by Vidura to Maitreya Muni. And these, we see that he's put forward many very intelligent, very deep questions in order to, but his purpose there is to become fixed up in pure devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and to be situated in that one service with his mind and senses and words, all without any diversion at all to anything else. So that's the purpose of his inquiries. Generally, people don't ask questions like this. Bhakti Bhavana, and we had a discussion. Were you there? Were you there the last Saturday?
Last day.
Last Saturday.
No.
No. So, there's a lot of members of the Indian congregation, or new, you know, people who have been around for maybe 6 months or so, but have you know, been getting some good association with Nityananda Priya and his all the team down there at Bhakti Baba. Anyway, they asked me to speak on Krishna, and of course you know that when you're speaking to new people, especially from the Indian congregation, their mind's going to be fixed on anything else but Krishna, this God, that God. So, I asked them just to, was asked them that you know, what is your background in festival worshipping their particular family deity, they all sort of joined in like that, and they considered it all equal. So whether they worship Krishna or Ganesha, so, you know, they... and what struck me was that the prime reason that they were worshipping those particular gods was not because somewhere along the line someone had asked questions and researched the Vedic literatures as to who should be worshipped and for what purpose, but simply because it was just passed down, that that's what their family had done, and therefore that's what they would do, and that's what their children would do, and that will go on for thousands of years, I think. So, you know, that was really interesting for me. And, you know, the surprising thing was very interesting for them, because I don't think they quite, the penny had really dropped, that that's what they were doing. So when, you know, when I said that, you know, it's like, even they were a bit surprised. Oh, geez, what are we doing? People, you know, even, you know, not just Hinduism, but, you know, people are born in a Muslim country, they will worship Allah, they will follow the Muslim tradition. And if they're born in a particular community, they will worship Allah with a particular mood. Some will be very militant, some will be very peaceful, some will be very meditative, some will be very saintly, some will be very material. It just depends upon, you know, the mood of that community. They'll worship him in, you know, not all in the same mood. Same with Christianity. Depends where you're born. You will take up worship of the Father of Jesus, I'm sure what they call him, Jehovah. Some call him Jehovah. Or if you're born in the Jewish community, Yahweh, like that. You're born in the Buddhist community, like that. There's not a... they generally won't question the mode of worship or, you know, anything, or, you know, should we worship, you know, in another way. You know, it's just what is going on in that community that would just be passed on. Okay. So, what happens there, of course, is that a lot of that worship is based upon, as long as one's you know, material requisites, you know, the prerequisites are being satisfied, one will continue that worship. We see that Prabhupada mentions that in India, many of the Hindus, when the Muslims took over, they put a special tax on Hindus, so that, you know, it was more difficult financially. You were better off to be a Muslim, and so, and also, as Prabhupada mentions, the Brahmanas were treating the Sudras, which made up practically the whole population, as untouchable. Oh, you know, I don't even look at you. You know, don't walk down the same street as me. Imagine doing that. You sort of walk down the street, and Brahman says, don't you ever walk down the street again. You go to the back lane like that. I don't want to have to see your face. So, the, you know, that's, it was very, the Brahmins become very proud, you know, and, so a lot of the Hindus thought, we'll get a better deal with the Muslims. And so, you know, they become a huge proportion of Muslims are Hindus. And we have the same happening in the Western world now, that although people are born in Christian countries, many of them feel that society, especially if they're somehow or another, you know, so much out of love of Allah, but out of disturbance within the society that they're living in. You know, they don't necessarily research, others like this, others like that, you know, Muslim like this. I'm so disturbed, and some almost out of a rebellious nature. So therefore, when there's no religion or one's worship of deity is chosen out of family tradition, or and generally based upon one's material well-being, there's no resolute determination to stick to that path. As soon as someone comes along and offers a better deal somewhere, that will change their faith. Just like actually in China. In China now, Christianity, I think there are more Christians than practically any other group in China. And of course, what's happened in China is that in the last 20 years or so, the economy has boomed. So you have a whole nation wherein within practically within our lifetime we've been able to see that literally you have a country with a huge problem with poverty, and now that same population are all becoming wealthy within a short time. But what they've also seen in their lifetime is the destruction of their rivers, the land, and the environment, which is against their original sort of Taoist traditions, where nature is to be respected because it's been created by the gods. So many of them are turning to religion. And now, even within the Communist Party, Christianity is so big and unstoppable that a communist is now allowed to go to church. Because previously, a communist wasn't allowed to go to church and worship. But now, you can actually be a communist and go to church and be Christian as well. That's accepted because times have changed. But, so many of them have changed from their traditional religions, then to communism, then to Christianity, and in the future they'll change again according to the prevailing circumstances. Like that, so change. But you don't see that they actually research. That's not the reason why they change. It's usually because there's some better deal and they feel more accepted, there's a sense of spirituality, and underlying everything, people do yearn for a sense of spirituality, but sometimes it can be, a very shallow sense of spirituality. But there's an element of bhakti there, but because the main element there is strong material desires to be fulfilled, it's not really bhakti. Prabhupada often mentions it, when the Muslims pray, when the Buddhists pray, when the Christians pray, there's bhakti. Shravanam, kirtanam, smaranam. Parasevanam, archanam, dasyam, sakyam, pandanam, dasyam, sakyam, apnavedam. So pandanam, Prabhupada calls it, when they're praying, that's vandana. This is a bhakti. They're praying to God, so it's bhakti. There's an element of bhakti there. But it's not bhakti proper when we're principally praying for material desires to be fulfilled. That's not bhakti proper, but there's an element there. we see from the devotees, they do things in a whole different way. Here, the Dura is actually asking, the most, many, many varieties of questions, deeply penetrating into the subject, leaving no stone unturned, in order to leave no doubt whatsoever and to fix one's resolve as to who should be the supreme worshipful Lord to devote one to surrender to. So that is the bhakti path. That is different. That is the difference between bhakti and other forms of faith. You won't find that. And if someone does have that strong desire to actually understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who should be worshipped and how, generally they will come to Krishna consciousness anyway. Because by comparative understanding, naturally, and by one's sincerity, gradually one will actually be led to Krishna consciousness. So, Prabhupada mentions this verse in the Bhagavad Gita, as stated in the Bhagavad Gita 241, devotional service to the Lord is one, and the mind of the devotee is not diverted to the many branches of uncertainties. So, this verse from the Bhagavad Gita is the Dura's single pointed, what do they call that? Vyavasaya Nikabudhiya. Resolute determination. That is a quality that you'll find within the devotee. It is a quality of devotional service. As long as we're doing some sort of business for our own purpose, we won't resolutely stick with one person. You know, if you go to the shop and you're doing business with one person, you're buying cars, every couple of years you upgrade your car, and they look after you, treat you well, and then you find next time you go to buy a car, the person, the opposition, car sales, they're actually doing a better deal. So you just change at that. It's business. It's business. You don't fall in love with the car salesman. Oh, he's like a brother to me, I've got this nice holding from him. He's like part of the family. It's just business. Bhakti is based upon love for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, it's a resolute, it's not doing business. And it has these qualities. These are mentioned in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that Krishna is encouraging Arjuna, and of course encouraging us, about taking up bhakti yoga. Because it is supreme among all processes, and he's saying taking that bhakti yoga, and that bhakti means to worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead, not the demigods. So in verse 240, he describes that if you characteristics of bhakti is that there is a resolute determination, because it is based upon transcendental knowledge of the benefit of the soul initially. Initially, the understanding of the Supreme Personality of Godhead may be there, but bhakti is based upon the eternal benefit of the soul. Whereas most religious processes described in the Vedas mainly deal, or you know, other religious processes mainly deal with the modes of material nature, fulfilling one's material, you know, requirements by, you know, invoking those material benedictions from the Lord. So bhakti has that resolute determination, because one is looking after the interest of the soul. When we look after the interest of the body, then you have so many desires to fulfill. If you look after the interest of the soul, there's just one. All the desires associated with the material body don't fit into that category. All the unlimited desires in this material world don't fit into that category of looking after the soul. So there's looking after the soul, and then there's one desire, and then all the unlimited desires of the material world, they're associated with looking after the body. So only those who take that bhakti, you're initially looking after the interests of the soul, trying to understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead, they can have resolute determination. They can be situated in that oneness. And if, in verse 44, describes that if one is attached to material opulence or sense enjoyment, they create obstacles, you know, to having that resolute determination or to developing that bhakti. Also in that same verse 45 describes that the bhakti, although it's in the Vedas, it's transcendental. Krishna asks Arjuna, you rise above the majority of those things in the Vedas, you take that transcendental element, that bhakti, and that in the next verse he describes, if you perform bhakti, it will fulfill all requirements. There's no need to perform any other activity. So this also makes it very easy to be resolute in devotional service, because a devotee understands if you perform bhakti to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, everything that is required to be done and satisfied, all duties that need to be executed, they're all fulfilled by bhakti yoga. In other words, if you worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead nicely, all the demigods be satisfied, you don't have to offer worship to them, your relatives are satisfied, society is satisfied, you're satisfied, all living entities are satisfied, and then you don't have to separately engage in any other activity, you don't have any other duty to do. You know, in the same chapter, he describes verses 50-51 that, you know, by performing bhakti, all your sinful reactions are taken away. At that as well. Which is different from other processes, because actually, if you perform karma yoga, you're performing your duties, you know, as good as you possibly can. If you don't complete that activity, say you're worshipping a demigod, or you're even looking after your children, your parents, something, you know, perform your duty in this world, one way or another, your material duty. If you don't execute it properly, you are susceptible to the sinful reaction. Of not executing your duty. So you're trying to do something pious, but if you fail to do it, no danger of his being unsuccessful. On the other hand, a non-devotee, though fully engaged in occupational duties, does not gain anything. So therefore, as also described, Krishna described in verse 52, that second chapter, that therefore one becomes indifferent to the Vedic rituals by performing bhakti. And in verse 51, it also describes that one not only becomes free from sinful actions, but one becomes free from the cycle of birth and death, which is also not achieved in the other processes. And in verse 53, it describes that one attains samadhi, or realization of one's relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, you know, ultimately, goes back to Godhead. So, Krishna, just in a few short verses of the Bhagavad Gita, describing the glories of bhakti, when one hears about bhakti, one can have resolute determination that all I need to do is bhakti. I don't need to do anything else. All I need to do is worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead and become situated in bhakti. And actually, Prabhupada mentions that, just like we see that. Scriptural injunctions that if one is a brahmana and they don't perform the Garbhodana samskara, that means the ceremony in order to the proper Vedic purification ceremony for the conception of a child, as described, if that is not performed by a brahmana, one may think, oh, maybe the child will become sudra. But actually, the injunction is the whole family becomes sudra. And of course, if the whole family becomes sudra, they may then take their next birth sudra bodies. Therefore, you find that. Now, Prabhupada mentions, but if amongst those brahmanas, if somehow or another they've engaged in some devotional service, and perhaps they, become sudras in the next life, there's no problem for them, because they get swept back up into devotional service, and by devotional service they come to the brahminical platform anyway. So, you see that by even just a small amount of devotional service, they're protected from any fall down. And when Prabhupada was in New Vrindavan, he said that. He said that in one lecture. That June 21, 1969, he's giving a verse from the Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 5, verses 17, which is what I've just quoted there, 17 and 18. He says that, but see, practically, even though we've fallen in this abominable condition, some way or another, but because in their last life they had some advancement of Krishna consciousness, according to the verse 240, even a little advancement, even just a little, immediately they are taking up, he said, a little advancement in Krishna consciousness, immediately they are taking up. So those who are joining in this movement in this country, they were supposed to be previously Krishna conscious. Somehow or another, they could not execute Krishna consciousness in full. So Prabhupada is describing that many devotees, who are spread throughout all the various countries of the world, sea and fallen down, you know, as everyone does in Kali Yuga, you know, falling down from the Brahminical platform or the platform of Sattva to Rajas and Tamas, like that. Everyone is coming down to Rajas and Tamas, you know, like that. But if there's a little bit of Krishna consciousness, they have no fear of that. What to speak of those who are taking that Krishna consciousness very solidly. But, you know, when it mentions that one has to perform Krishna consciousness in their previous lifetime, we understand that the beginning of that may be Yata Sukriti. Someone, you know, just like that, Harinam Kirtan. Someone hears the holy name of the Lord. There's another verse here.
See this within every devotee. Every devotee, you know,
sincere devotee, you see that they love to, you know, research properly about Krishna consciousness, always studying the scriptures, asking questions, and trying to find out, just making sure that if there's any doubt or anything that's a distraction to the ultimate goal of the soul, to be properly situated in its eternal position, which means as eternal servant of Krishna, devotees are always inquiring and researching with great single-minded determination, how that can be achieved. And of course, Prabhupada mentions in that verse that yesterday's verse, and also in 241 of the Bhagavad Gita, that is achieved by accepting the spiritual master as one supreme guide and friend. Because the spiritual master is a representative of Krishna, one takes full shelter. You see in the Nectar Devotion, devotional service properly begins, in seriousness. That is the first step. One takes shelter of the spiritual master. Find some very, very experienced, well-situated devotee, elevated devotee, who's very expert and fully realized in Krishna consciousness, and one, takes shelter. Let me learn from that person, and gradually inquires from that person, and then, may you take initiation from that person, and then may also follow the rules and regulations and the instructions very fully. And those beginning steps of devotional service are tantamount to bhakti. Bhakti is there. That resolute determination. It manifests when one does that. One takes shelter of the spiritual master. That is that resolute determination. Bhakti can be there to some degree, but it's a big step. It's a real, everyone knows, it's a very serious step when one takes shelter. Otherwise, without the being obliged to follow the instructions of a spiritual master, we tend to be literally doing as we please in spiritual life. Sense gratification can literally be guiding us, as it has done for many, many generations like that, as to, our spiritual life is literally being guided by our mind and our senses like that. But when one takes shelter of the spiritual master and inquires very, very sincerely, and then takes those instructions of the spiritual master very seriously, and bhakti is really taking shape properly. That is a mistake. Therefore, Prabhupada, when he read this verse from 241, he was struck with wonder at Vishwanath Chakrabarti's wonderful commentary on that. I'll just read his commentary to verse 241. We'll just finish there. He says, Srila Vishwanath Chakrabarti the core writes, "Of all kinds of intelligence, the best is intelligence focused on bhakti yoga. In bhakti yoga, one's intelligence becomes single-pointed or fixed in determination. One thinks, the instructions of my spiritual master to worship the personality of Godhead by chanting, remembering, serving his feet and so on, are my only sadhana, my only sadhya, my only livelihood. I am incapable of giving up these instructions either in the stage of practice or in the stage of perfection. They alone are my object of desire and my only responsibility. Besides them, I can desire no other responsibility, not even in my dreams. It is all the same to me whether I feel happy or unhappy, or whether my material existence is eradicated." Bhakti, resolute determination, having that faith in the spiritual master representing Krishna. So I'll just leave it there if anyone has.
is described as forbidden, so do devotees get some kind of reaction for that? Or?
Yeah, that's really okay. Unless you go speak to restaurants, that one. the nature of the devotee is that having a single-minded focus on Krishna means that they see Krishna everywhere, and therefore they see all living entities as part and parcel of Krishna. And they understand that every living entity is a spirit soul and very dear to Krishna. So, you know, they don't want to do anything unnecessary to cause harm to other living entities. So I don't want to go into specifics, but sometimes, just like with Yudhishthira Maharaj, he had to kill because he was removing not just insects and bugs and what have you, he was removing human beings. He described that, you know, the Pandavas under Yudhishthira Maharaj, they were eradicating the soldiers on the battlefield, just like a farmer eradicates the weeds in his fields. So that just like when they pull up a weed, they're just eradicating human beings like that. So I don't want to go into specifics, but but Krishna wanted it. So this is what a devotee has to always see is is this something that's satisfying Krishna, or is it something I want? So we see that with Arjuna, Yudhisthira, they were not prepared to harm even an ant if it was not what Krishna wanted. But if Krishna wanted it, they were prepared to eradicate everyone. So that's the principle. I won't go into detail, but that's the principle. All right, so we'll just leave it there. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, the dangers of that, as Prabhupada mentions in that section of the, I think it was that, the Srimad Bhagavatam verse, okay, at 1.5.17, it was quoted there, that sometimes devotees who do become, because the obstacles for that resolute determination is if one again becomes attracted to sense gratification or material opulence, enjoying those things for one's purpose, one can, instead of being fixed up in the service of the spiritual master for Krishna, one becomes engaged in other activities, and one can fall down from devotional service, even from a very elevated platform, such as Bharat Maharaj, who fell down from practically the platform of Bhava Bhakti and became a deer. So the danger is that if a devotee again becomes irresolute by becoming attracted to other things, they can fall down, even take birth in the animal species. But the benefit is that they're never lost. Therefore, because Bharat Maharaj had performed devotional service, he was given the opportunity that he could remember his past life as a devotee. See, that's a special. So the performance of bhakti saved him. So even as a deer, he was able to quickly take himself back to the proper platform in the next lifetime. facility of being protected even when one falls down. So bhakti is like that, that you know, if one is very immature and does not become fully perfected Krishna consciousness in this lifetime, we don't know what where we will end up in our next life. We don't know what birth we may take. And there may be some, you know, disturbing situations we have to face as a result of, you know, maybe offences to Krishna, offences to Guru, offences to Shastra, offences to Vaishnavas, or sinful activities, you know, against the holy name, you know, like that. So we may have to take birth and suffer all sorts of different reactions like that, where Krishna purifies us of that tendency to enjoy in this material world, even as a devotee. And then the bhakti at some stage will kick in, and one will come back to exactly where they left off. So that's the benefit of bhakti. You're guaranteed that you'll be given the opportunity very quickly to come back to the platform where you left off. That's, it's never lost. Never lost. It can be stalled for some time, your progress. And we may end up in a bit of a pickle, a bit of a difficult situation in the material world. As we know, you know, devotees take birth in all sorts of places all over the world. And some of them, you know, some take birth in the middle of a war zone, some take birth in, you know, an animal, in a deer. Some take birth in, you know, they may go for many, many years of extreme difficulty where Krishna has to, you know, purify them. In one lifetime, not over thousands of lifetimes, but in one lifetime, Krishna will slap them around a bit. Nah, don't you do that again. You take it seriously this time. And then they, you know, come back. Then he gives them the opportunity when they think. You know, I never forget the first moment I literally found the Gita. I've told this story a few times, but I'll tell it because it fits us. You know, I was a typical Western teenager, trying my best to enjoy as a teenager in the Western world, and suffering like anything, suffering. I hated it. I hated my life. You know, every weekend was a party since I was 10. I'll say no more. I was smoking at 10 and drinking, and then 10 years old. And my father used to let me wander out in the street. I could come home at 2 o'clock if I wanted, even as a kid. A very wild existence, and but you know, by the time I got to about 18 and 19, well, even years before that, I was so disturbed that you know, I felt my life was so shallow and empty, and literally I was just suffering, you know, intoxication, you know, so many things, and I thought, I can't stand to do this anymore, not for even one more second. I was at a party when I was thinking. I was actually at a party, intoxicated, and I said, I can't stand this any longer. And I reached into the library, I thought, I'm just going to pick out the biggest book I can, and I'm just going to sit here, and I'm bored with all you guys, I don't want anything. I pulled out the Bhagavad Gita, and, you know, my eyes were sort of rolling all over the place, and I was quite intoxicated. But I thought, this is what I'm looking for, you know, and I went downstairs and I tried to read it and I thought, this is it, you know, I need to be sober to read it. And so I said to the lady who owned the party, who was an ex-girlfriend, I said, can I have this book? And we'd broken up, you know, and she said, I'll give you this book if you give me your diary, because she wanted to read about the breakup of my diary. So I said, yeah, you have the diary. I never used to write anything about that anyway. And I took the Bhagavad Gita. But, you know, I never forget at that point where I was disgusted with material existence, Bhagavad Gita literally jumped in my head. So, at that point. So, you know, you can see that, you know, it's like that. You know, sometimes for one reason or another, you know, Krishna puts you to some, you know, Krishna consciousness that may be a little beginning, but it's not enough, and there may be all sorts of things done improperly. So you take birth, and there's some, you know, serious, you know, reactions, and then, you know, but you immediately you In the Nectar of Devotion, it says, what saves a devotee is the bhakti rasa. It's that taste, that bhakti rasa. When you perform, just like, you know, I say to some of these people that the children come to do, I did a ceremony the other day for a little girl, she's about 9 months old. So I started the kirtan and she had her legs start dancing away. I mean, she can't stand or anything. I said to her, stand her up, you know, and she's both legs are going, and she's like this, she's got a big smile. She's 9 months old. But, you know, I can see that bhakti ras, she may never find that sense of happiness and well-being and peace again in her life, except with devotees. And that moment, she will search for even in her next life if she doesn't attain it. You know? That it's that bhakti rasa, and when you taste it, I remember I used to read the Gita, I used to open the Gita and I'd read it, and when I'd say Krishna, I'd be like, licking my lips, I'd be thinking, you know, Krishna, there's something, it's not like a word, it's like, you know, I'm tasting something. What is that? It's like there's a bhakti rasa there. So, you know, it's not just... I didn't understand Bhagavad Gita, but I could taste something. You know, just reading Krishna's name. And I'll tell you why I know I didn't understand Bhagavad Gita. Because I used to do, I didn't have many jobs, but I had one for a couple of weeks where I was a landscape gardener. And we used to, you know, you do a lawn. So first you get all the dirt and you rake up all the rubble and things like that. You put it in the wheelbarrow and you just sort of throw that rubbish over the edge. So I was reading the Bhagavad Gita and I'd fill up the barrel with all the rubbish and then I'd be thinking, I'm supposed to offer everything to Krishna, so I'd go to the edge and, there you go, Krishna, I don't know what you want with all this rubbish, but you know, it's yours, I'm offering everything to you, like that. So, you know, I had no real understanding of bhakti at all, but there was a taste, you know, there was that bhakti rasa. So it's not intellectual.